Not all monsters are myths.
Michigan Monsters.
This is Michigan Monsters. A true crime gothic.
Oh, hi. Welcome to Michigan, where the lakes are salt-free, the monsters are human, and the summers are killer. I'm Jen Carpenter, and today we're going to do another revisit, all the way back to season one, the same episode that Amanda Davies was originally covered in. It was an episode where we did five kind of brief overviews of cases, and I wanted to go back and do deep dives on some of them. We did Amanda Davies earlier in the season, and today we are going to revisit the unsolved murder of Bernita White in Lansing in 2001. And if you could see me right now, heavy on the air quotes around the word unsolved. If you were in the Lansing area in the early 2000s, you remember this one, probably vividly, and you already know. But it's been 25 years now, almost exactly, since the mother of two was gunned down at Potter Park Zoo in broad daylight. So there are plenty of folks out there who aren't familiar with Lansing's most solved, unsolved murder. And while there are quite a few podcasts out there about this case already, I'm wagering a bet that this is the first one you'll listen to done by someone who was at the zoo that day. Yeah, let's go. It's summertime in Michigan, the time of year when the city folks scatter to little beach towns all up and down the Great Lakes coastline for long weekends, entire weeks, the whole summer if they're among God's favorites, but not all of us get to live that cottage life, and we spend the sweltering summer months, it's not the heat, it's the humidity, okay, trying to find ways to keep the kids busy. One of the most popular family destinations in the Lansing area is Potter Park Zoo, Michigan's first and now oldest public zoo. The 102-acre park is located along the Red Cedar River on Lansing's south side and has been entertaining the masses through animal education in an official capacity since 1920, but the zoo got its start long before that. In 1910, 58 acres of wooded land were donated to the city by Lansing pioneers James and Sarah Pa'a for the creation of Pa'a Park. A few years later, they donated another 27 acres and then more after that. Around the same time, Lansing's first zoo was being established a few miles away in Rio Town's own Moores Park, where a herd of elk donated by another of Lansing's pioneer families, the Turners of Turner Dodge infamy, was being kept along with a herd of deer, a bear, and two raccoons. Okay, elk aside, that really just sounds like my backyard, but okay. The size of Potter Park and the animal population at Moores Park continued to grow exponentially and simultaneously so that it eventually only made sense to move the animals from Moores Park to the much bigger Potter Park and establish the Potter Park Zoo. The zoo officially opened in 1920, making it Michigan's first public zoo. Today, more than 100 years later, Potter Park Zoo still sits on over 100 acres and houses close to 400 animals across nearly 100 different species. It hosts upwards of 200,000 guests per year, and it is also conveniently located right next to the home of Lansing's very own cryptid, Big Penny. Big Penny, for those of you who may be wondering what the fuck I'm talking about, is a low-lying overpass bridge that is infamous for eating trucks, campers, semis, basically any vehicle that is over 12 feet tall. The bridge was built by the Grand Trunk Railroad back in 1928 when cars were very small, and 12 feet was tall enough for any and every vehicle to make it under. But now, even with flashing lights and giant reflective signs very clearly stating that if your vehicle is over 12 feet tall, it will not fit under the bridge, big old trucks keep trying the FAFO theory and losing bigly. As a result, Big Penny munches at least a couple of big trucks every week, which is why we love her. She even had a face for a while. A local group installed some giant eyes and teeth on both sides of the bridge, maybe like a year ago, maybe a little less than that, which still didn't stop two big trucks from trying to get through. But some asshat tore her face off. That sounds awful. Somebody tore Big Penny's face off. That's a true crime I need to do an episode on. A few months ago. And there are talks to fix it, you know, reinstall new art to give her face back, but nothing has happened yet. Even still, face or no, Big Penny remains a local icon. And if you've ever been to Potter Park Zoo, you've either driven underneath her to get there, or at the very least, seen her big old blinking lights that nobody pays attention to as you turned into the zoo entrance. When I was growing up in the 80s, the Potter Park Zoo was less than 5 miles from my house, and admission was about 1/10 of what it is now. So it was a nearby, very affordable way to spend some time, so we went there a lot. My favorite things were the miniature train ride that went over the river and through the woods and under a tunnel, and the guinea pig hill, which was like this giant hill. Think Teletubbies. It when Teletubbies came out years later, their hill reminded me of the guinea pig hill. This big fenced-in hill, and it was full of like holes and tunnels, and there were just guinea pigs running all over the place and squeaking about, and they were so cute. My least favorite things were the primate room, which, whilst home to the coolest animals in the zoo, it smelled so bad. I could barely stand going in there as a kid. I hated it. And that was the big draw, was that area, and I wanted nothing to do with it. I just want to go look at the guinea pigs. And then the reptile and bird room for the same reason, plus noise, because those birds be squawking loud AF. But remember, this was a 1980s zoo. Standards were much different back then, and that shit was so gross. It was gross. All of those exhibits are much improved and much, much, much more enjoyable these days. Point is, I was at this zoo a lot as a kid. So when I became a mom, we went to the zoo all the time. So often, in fact, that most of the, like, me taking the kid to the zoo memories are kind of all jumbled into one big memory, except for one trip. On June 23rd, 2001. I was 21, I had just bought my first house and moved back to Lansing Southside. My son was 2, and he loved the zoo. His favorites were the big spider monkey exhibit and the penguins. I don't even think the penguins were there when I was a kid, to be honest with you. I don't remember them, but he loved them. June 23rd was a perfect weather day, 70s and sunny, so we went to the zoo early, the goal being that running around for a couple hours in the fresh air looking at the animals would tire my kid out and he might actually take a nap so that I could get some stuff done around the house. I don't remember exactly what time we were there. I do remember that it was mid-afternoon when we left and that Austin was asleep in his car seat before we even made it out of the parking lot. On our way out, we passed a birthday party happening in one of the pavilions. So there's a big area outside the zoo where they've got pavilions, playgrounds, picnic tables, grills, and you can rent them out for parties and other events. So I do remember that, seeing that there was a birthday party and kind of clocking like, dang, I wish my kid's birthday was not in February. And then we could have like an outdoor party at the zoo and that would be fun and he would love that. But February in Michigan is not really conducive to outdoor zoo time. So we drove home a whopping 2.5 miles away and we went about our day. But then the evening news came on. Remember, this is 2001, there's no social media yet, so we actually had to watch the news to see what was going on in the world. And I was shocked to see that the lead story was about a murder at Potter Park Zoo earlier that day. The details were chilling. A little before 3:30 in the afternoon, a mother walking with her daughter from a birthday party outside the zoo toward the zoo's entrance was hit by a single bullet that entered through her left arm, pierced her heart, and exited out her right side. She was pronounced dead at Sparrow Hospital a short time later. The zoo, which had about 300 people visiting at the time, was evacuated for the first time in its nearly 100-year history and would be closed until further notice. And the shooter was still at large. In the first article posted in the Lansing State Journal about the murder the following day, which was obviously very early on in the investigation, authorities said that they were leaning toward the shooting being completely random. Lieutenant Raymond Hall said, and I quote, "This could be anything from an accidental discharge to an intentional homicide, but they'd have to be one hell of a good shot." At the time, the detective had no idea how true that sentiment would turn out to be. Bernita K. Sims was born on February 3, 1960, to Benny and Barbara Sims in Detroit. She was one of six children. She graduated from Pershing High School on Detroit's North Side in 1978, then from Wayne State University a few years after that. After college, she was working in the handbag department at her local JCPenney when she met and fell in love with store security guard Artis White. Side note, I also used to work in the ladies' handbag department at JCPenney. I was still in high school, though, I think, at the time. Anyway, Artis White was a former National Guardsman who was training to become a police officer. The two were married on November 25th, 1989, when they were both 29 years old. After Artis graduated from the Michigan State Police Training Academy, he was assigned to the State Police Post in Lansing. So the couple moved to the capital city and settled in a home in Delta Township, a suburb just west of Lansing. Bernita took a job as a systems analyst with Electronic Data Systems, while Artis worked his way up to detective sergeant with the Michigan State Police. The couple's first daughter, Alana, was born in 1993 when they were both 33. Their second daughter, Michaela, was born 2.5 years later. The Whites had a picture-perfect life, at least from the outside. But about 10 years into their marriage, the cracks began to show. Artis and Bernita spent a couple years in couples counseling before ultimately deciding to divorce. According to Artis, the split was amicable. They'd simply grown apart. They were still living together, still going to church and family functions together to keep the girls' routine as normal as possible for as long as they could. They would share joint custody. They were both already even seeing other people. Their marriage was over. The rest was just paperwork. Easy peasy. According to Artis. June 23rd, 2001 was a Saturday, and despite the beautiful weather forecast, 70s and sunny, things started out rough in the White household. Artis got up around 5:30 a.m., which he said was late for him, and he left the family's one-year-old yellow lab outside, only for it to promptly escape the backyard. The entire family got up and set about the neighborhood looking for young Chili, but had no luck, only to return home and find a message on their answering machine from a neighbor who'd corralled the pup and was keeping him safe. Crisis averted, which was a good thing because there was a lot going on that day. Both girls had birthday parties to attend for friends at the same time on opposite ends of town. So the Whites left their Delta Township home in the family van around 12:30 that day. Their first stop was Delta Mills Park on the city's west side, not far from home. They dropped 7-year-old Alana off at her friend's party to fly kites and swing on the swings and play games, and then they drove the 10-mile, 17-minute drive in good traffic to Potter Park Zoo on the south end of town for 5-year-old Michaela's friend's party. The White family was likely arriving at the zoo right about the time that my son and I were leaving, because remember I said we saw a birthday party on our way out, so the party that I saw kind of getting started was likely the party that they were headed to, which is crazy in retrospect to think about. The party was in one of those pavilions outside the zoo in the park area. The plan was for the kids to play games, destroy a piñata, have cake, open presents, and then go in and explore the zoo. Bernita and Artis intended to hang out while Michaela participated in the birthday festivities, then leave when the rest of the group got ready to head into the zoo so they could go back across town and pick Alana up before her friend's party ended. But little Michaela didn't like that plan, according to her father. Like any five-year-old would, she wanted to go to the zoo with her friends. The zoo that was right there, within walking distance, within her line of sight. Who takes a five-year-old to a birthday party at a zoo and then doesn't plan to actually go into the zoo? Like, they just set themselves up for failure with that plan that day. So, the new plan became that Bernita would stay with Michaela and the two of them would go to the zoo with the rest of the party, while Artis would drive back across town to Delta Mills Park to get Alana, and then drive back to the zoo to meet up with Bernita and Michaela. So Artis and Bernita parted ways. Artis went back to the parking lot while Bernita and Michaela headed towards the zoo. Moments later, right around 3:15 p.m., the ear-splitting crack of a single shot from a high-powered rifle shattered the peace of a sunny day at the zoo for the hundreds of people in attendance. 41-year-old Bernita White, who was walking alongside her 5-year-old daughter, collapsed in a pool of blood, mortally wounded, by a single gunshot wound that entered through her left arm, pierced her heart, and exited through her right side. Life-saving efforts that began almost immediately and the fact that the hospital was less than 2 miles away were of no consequence. Bernita was gone. And Artis had no idea. As children cowered behind trees and family friends administered CPR to Bernita and comforted Michaela, and reports of an active shooter at Potter Park Zoo flooded the 911 switchboard, and every law enforcement official in the 517 raced towards the scene, 41-year-old Artis White was driving in the opposite direction towards Delta Mills Park. According to his GPS, Artis arrived at Delta Mills roughly 30 minutes after leaving Potter Park. He talked with some of the other parents for a bit, then he and Alana headed back toward the zoo. They arrived on the scene right around 4:30 and found pure chaos waiting for them. The zoo was simultaneously barricaded and being evacuated. There were people and cars and police and news crews everywhere. One Fox 47 reporter even caught a strange scene on film, though he didn't know it at the time. His camera was too far away to pick up the sound, but the images he captured were chilling. In them, a tall black man walks up to a police officer, has a brief exchange with him, laughs, and then returns to his vehicle. That man was Artis White, and according to him, the exchange went something like this. Unable to enter the zoo and unable to reach Bernita by phone, he approached a Lansing police officer that he recognized and he asked him what was going on. When the officer told him that a middle-aged black woman took one to the chest, Artis responded, "Well, I hope it's not my wife. Things are rough, but not that bad." The two men had a chuckle about this, and then Artis returned to his vehicle to try to find another way into the zoo. This is his story. Like, this is his version of that conversation, which is crazy work. Crazy work. Even if you're not a police officer who's seen the worst of the worst, your wife and your little girl are in the zoo. Your wife fits the description of a woman that was shot, and you're fucking joking about it while your family is missing. You can't get a hold of your wife. You don't know where her and your daughter are. Like, crazy work. As this was going on, just up Pennsylvania Avenue at Sparrow Hospital, the trauma team informed officers that their victim was unable to be resuscitated and had succumbed to her injuries. Detective Sergeant Darren Larner, who would become the lead investigator on the case, remembers standing in the room with Bernita's body surrounded by chaos. By this point, law enforcement was aware that Bernita was the wife of one of their own. But the moment Detective Sergeant Larner laid eyes on Detective Sergeant Artis White, any empathy he had for the man dissipated. In an interview he did with Crimecasters Network a few years ago, Detective Larner said that as soon as he saw Artis White enter the room where Bernita's body lay in wait for official identification, he knew. He recalled that the look on Artis's face was that of a man coming to make sure the job was done, not of a husband grieving. Artis White was responsible for his wife's death, and Detective Sergeant Larner was going to prove it, but not before tragedy struck again. Bernita White's parents still lived in Detroit, where she grew up. Artists claimed to have called them a few times, but was unable to reach them. So at 10 o'clock that night, Michigan State Police troopers knocked on 67-year-old Barbara Sims' front door and informed her that her daughter had been killed. When officers left, Barbara fell into such hysterics that neighbors had to go get her daughter Bridget, who lived nearby. When Bridget arrived at her mother's house, she found Barbara on the floor, inconsolable, screaming, "Bernita's dead," over and over. She then began to scream, "He did it. He killed her. He did it. He did it," on repeat. When Bridget asked her who she was talking about, her mom said, "Artis. Artis killed Bernita." Barbara then explained to her daughter, as best she could through her hysterics, that Bernita had been confiding in her that she was afraid of Artis, that he had become volatile and unpredictable, and she was worried about what he was going to do to her. The words were coming so fast and frantic that Bridget suggested her mom write it all down so that they could take this information to the police. So Barbara stood up to walk over to her desk and get her notebook, but instead collapsed at Bridget's feet. She suffered a fatal heart attack and was pronounced dead on the same day that her daughter was murdered. It didn't take long for authorities to figure out that Artis's account of an amicable divorce between loving co-parents was nothing more than a work of fiction. Bernita's friends and family told a very different story, one much more befitting of the soulless man Detective Sergeant Larner encountered at the hospital that awful day. A story in which Bernita had become increasingly paranoid in recent months, worried that Artis was following her, spying on her, bugging her surroundings, listening to her calls. She was afraid of him and afraid to leave him alone with their daughters. On May 24th, 2001, Bernita White filed for divorce from Artis and requested sole custody of the girls. One day shy of a month later, she was murdered. Between those two dates, the Whites attended multiple custody hearings. While Bernita wanted sole custody, Artis, who was reportedly against the divorce entirely, despite his claims to the contrary later, requested shared custody 50-50. During one hearing, Bernita called a friend from the bathroom, nearly in hysterics. She told her friend that Artis was blackmailing her, threatening to release some compromising video he had of her with another man if she didn't agree to 50-50 custody. And this is so shady and weird to me because they were both seeing other people at this point by Artis's own admission. Shit, he married the coworker that he was having an affair with at the time of Bernita's death. He's still married to her today. So why he had such a problem all of a sudden with her seeing other people when it was something he knew and something he was also doing? Ridiculous. The friend Bernita was talking to on the phone was basically like, "So just agree to 50-50. What's the problem? That's pretty standard. He's a good dad." And Bernita just kept saying, "You don't understand. You don't understand." But couldn't or wouldn't elaborate further. The judge ruled that the couple would share custody temporarily until a more formal hearing down the road. A decision that Artis was happy with, but Bernita definitely was not. So a couple weeks later, on June 14th, Bernita submitted a letter to the court regarding custody, the contents of which are unknown to this day, to the public. Obviously, the letter exists, but has not been made public. Presumably, she laid out the reasons why she was afraid of Artis and did not want him having custody of the girls, possibly with some supporting facts. We really don't know. We don't know what the letter said, but we do know that it exists. On June 22nd, the day before Bernita White was murdered, her lawyer submitted a letter to the court claiming that she was being followed and threatened by a private investigator hired by Artis. Artis later admitted to hiring a private investigator to following Bernita, and it was discovered that he had been using the Law Enforcement Information Network, or LEIN system, to track and spy on not only Bernita, but some of her acquaintances. So all of those seemingly crazy accusations, he's following me, he's spying on me, he's listening to my calls, they were all turning out to be true. Now, I vividly remember, and again, this all happened before social media, I remember hearing, so it had to have come from a newspaper article or like a TV news feature, there being a report that she had put in writing, "If anything happens to me, Artis did it." I don't know if it's that letter that she submitted to the court on June 14th that we haven't seen, or if it was something else that she put somewhere else. But in looking for proof of that now, I was unable to find that that was accurate, but I vividly remember it at the time. And again, it wasn't like a social media rumor because social media didn't exist. But at the time, the belief was that there was something in writing somewhere that said, if something happens to me, Artis did it. Artis always used and continues to use the fact that Bernita was still living in the same house with him during the divorce and custody proceedings as proof that she wasn't afraid of him. And all of these things that her friends and family were saying were untrue. But it is not hard for any woman who's ever been in a dangerous relationship with kids involved to figure out what happened. If she was afraid of him, and there is strong evidence that she was, if she was afraid to leave her children with him, and there is strong evidence that she was not leaving that house without her babies. He wasn't going to leave, right? He's not going to move out. He doesn't want the divorce. He doesn't want to give up the kids. She's not going to leave the house without the kids. This man is a police officer. He's got connections to law enforcement, to judges, to lawyers. Until she's got something in writing giving her full custody of her kids, she's not going any fucking where. And the fact that he used that in the other way, still uses that in the other way to say, well, she didn't leave, so it couldn't have been that bad. No, this is a mother that stayed for her children. And like, that's so obvious. And I hate that he tries to twist that fact to his benefit. Artis White was questioned for 6 hours on the day of Bernita's murder, while law enforcement officials combed through Potter Park Zoo looking for evidence, primarily the bullet that killed Bernita, which had to still be in the park since there was an exit wound. They combed the grounds, dragged the Red Cedar River, and even cut down a tree and had it x-rayed, all to no avail. To this day, the bullet remains unaccounted for. The zoo was closed for 2 days following its first ever evacuation, which again was unprecedented. The zoo is open every day. Weather aside, the zoo is always open except for on Christmas Day. So for it to be closed 2 days in a row in the middle of summer was very uncharacteristic. Taking witness statements was tricky because the scene at the zoo was chaos. There was an active shooter, so they had to evacuate the park as quickly as possible, but that meant letting hundreds of potential witnesses leave the scene. The Lansing Police Department put out a statement asking folks who were at the zoo at the time of the shooting to inspect their cars for bullet holes, to review any photos or videos they took that day for anything suspicious, to call the tip line if they'd seen anything out of the ordinary. But the general consensus was that while everyone heard the shot, which some people reported they heard 2 shots, but it's believed that was just kind of an echo, no one saw anything. Even without the bullet or weapon, authorities were able to determine that Bernita was killed by a single shot fired from a high-powered rifle located roughly 100 yards north of where Bernita was walking. This distance puts the shooter right near a fence at the tree line of the woods surrounding the park, which explains why nobody saw anything. Based on the trajectory, distance, and accuracy of the shot, authorities determined that this was not some random incident. Bernita was specifically and intentionally targeted, and there was only one person who stood to gain from Bernita's death. Search warrants were obtained for the Whites' home and vehicles, and a number of electronic devices were taken into evidence. Following his initial interview that first day, Artis lawyered up and refused any additional interview requests, as well as the request that he take a polygraph test. One thing that authorities didn't do, which does seem a little bit weird given that Artis was the primary suspect from the moment he walked into the hospital, was they didn't ever do a gunpowder residue test for him. This is something that Artis himself has specifically called out as proof of the Lansing Police Department's incompetence in the hours immediately following the shooting. And at first I was like, yeah, that's kind of weird, but let's be real. Artis was a state trooper. He wasn't going to raw dog a murder weapon. He would have worn gloves, and then he would have used the lack of gunpowder residue as another tool to claim innocence. Artis's alibi, of course, was that he was across town picking his daughter up from a birthday party when the shooting occurred. He even made it a point to tell investigators that he was on his cell phone talking to friends the entire time, so his phone records would back that up, showing his location as well. This was super suspicious to me. I mean, maybe Artis is just a talky guy. I don't know him. Maybe he always has to be talking to someone. But he told authorities that he called one friend, got his answering machine, so then he called another friend and talked to him the entire drive from Potter Park to Delta Mills. And maybe that was completely normal behavior for him. I don't know. But just the way he was so quick to explain it and that he had to call two different people in order to be on phone the whole time felt a little bit more like alibi building to me. But who's to say? Regardless of how many people Artis talked to and why, a recreation of the timeline of events proved that Artis's alibi was no alibi at all. According to his GPS, cell phone records, and the statement he gave police, it took Artis a half hour to get from Potter Park Zoo to Delta Mills that day. But the recreation revealed that Artis could have made that trip, including a quick detour to murder his wife, in 22 minutes. Authorities timed the trip from the park pavilion to where Artis's van was parked, to a service road at the zoo that led out to where they believed the shooter was positioned. They reenacted setting up the rifle, taking the shot, loading the rifle back up into the vehicle, and then driving out to Delta Mills Park. 22 minutes. 8 minutes less than it took Artis that day. So his alibi was not an alibi. While authorities continued to investigate and Artis continued to evade them, Bernita's family attended back-to-back funerals. One for Bernita in Lansing on June 29th and one for her mother in Detroit on June 30th. Every day, Bernita's dad, Benny, who lost his wife and daughter on the same day, called detectives to see what was happening with the case, if they had enough to arrest Artis yet. And every day, until the day he died just a year and a half later, they had to tell him, not yet. Well, I think it's fucking time. Depending on when you're listening to this episode, the 25th anniversary of Bernita White's murder is either fast approaching or just passed. June 23rd, 2026 marks 25 years since Bernita White was killed in a targeted hit while at a child's birthday party at a zoo in the middle of the day with her 5-year-old daughter. Police have only ever had one suspect, and now that lead investigator Darren Larner has retired from the Lansing Police Department, he can talk more freely about the case. So, I listened to a few different podcasts, read a bunch of different articles, but the most fascinating thing I found was a podcast called Crimecasters Network. They had a full audio podcast episode about this, and then a few bonus content YouTube videos that they released, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, right around the 20-year anniversary. So I watched one of the videos first, and I instantly recognized one of the women. It's Crimecasters Network was two women, two former reporters kind of out there doing it on their own now. But one of them specifically, I recognized her, and I felt like the version of her that I recognized was like quite a bit younger than the beautiful woman in the YouTube video. So, like, I recognize your face, but I remember it being much younger. Who are you? Where are you from? Even her name, Alyssa Safias, was familiar. The answer was in the podcast episode because she talked about it. She was an on-air anchor on one of our local news stations, Fox 47, to be exact, when this happened. So when I tell you that I went home from the zoo that day and then saw the story about the murder on the evening news, it's very likely that it was her I was watching, because Fox 47 news came on at 10 p.m. and everything else came on at 11. So I always watch the earlier one. And now here she is, 20 years later, still working on this case, now as an independent journalist, talking to the family, talking to retired law enforcement. She explained that of all of the cases that she's covered in all of her years in journalism, this is the one that stuck with her. She even talks about how she was alone in the newsroom that day when the alert came across the police scanner about an active shooter at the zoo. She was the one who called their on-call reporter to hurry to the scene, and that was the reporter I told you about earlier who caught that chilling footage, sans audio, of Artis walking up to a police officer and joking about what turned out to be his own wife's murder. podcast is definitely, definitely worth a listen and worth watching those videos on YouTube. Again, it's Crimecasters Network, and they refer to this story as the Zoo Sniper Case. And now, when you go watch it, you will not have to wonder why Alyssa Sophias looks so familiar, because I just told you. One absolutely bonkers thing that she talked about on the podcast was how she did a Freedom of Information request for all of the police files on the Bernita White case. The way a Freedom of Information Act request works is that you submit a request in writing to law enforcement. They have X amount of time to respond and tell you that either A, your request is approved and here's how much it's going to cost to give you the information that you want, or B, your request is denied and here's why. If it gets denied, you can appeal, blah, blah, blah. You can go back and forth for months and months over this. But her request, that initial request for everything on the case, was approved. The only problem was that the price tag for getting her the copies of all of the files was $42,000. So in a bunch of the articles I read, the Lansing Police Department said, like, in their memory, right, this was the hardest they'd ever worked on the case, the most manpower they'd ever put into a case. It had its own task force, just hours and hours and hours and hours, hundreds of interviews, thousands of hours of manpower poured into this case, resulting in a case file that would cost $42,000 to duplicate and give someone a copy of. So, like any normal human, Alyssa Sophias responded, okay, nope, I can't afford that, but since you approved my request for everything, I would like a few very specific things instead, and I'll pay for those versus the whole case file. And one of the main things that she wanted was that letter that Bernita wrote to the court back in June of 2001, just about a week before she was murdered. A letter, again, that presumably outlined why Artis should not have joint custody of the girls and why she was afraid of him. She wanted all of the 911 calls from that day and a few other things she mentioned. I don't remember what they were, but her request was once again approved. So she paid the deposit, half of whatever the new, more reasonable quote was, and then the Lansing Police Department had X amount of time to get her the information. That time, and I'm saying Lansing Police Department, it could have been Michigan State Police. I'm not sure who she did the FOIA request with, because both agencies were investigating, both the Lansing Police Department and Michigan State Police. So could have been either one there. But whoever it was, they had X amount of time to get her the information. That time came and went, so she keeps calling to check on it. And eventually she gets an email that's like, here's the link to your files. Have fun. Didn't say have fun, but you get the point. So she runs to her computer, she opens the link, and all of the pages are just blank. Not blacked out, because I've gotten FOIA requests where, like, so much information is blacked out that you might as well have nothing, but this was not that. They were just completely blank pages. So she calls back and she's like, what is this? And they're like, okay, yeah, so we did approve your request for this information twice, but did you then get our subsequent letter denying it? Which is a crazy thing to happen. Like, FOIA requests get denied all the time for all kinds of reasons. This is still an open case. They could have just denied the whole thing from jump. But the fact that they approved it at a crazy price tag, $42,000, is insane. And then approved an amended request and then denied it after she paid for it, that's what's crazy. That's what doesn't happen. Once your request is approved, it's approved. So that's really weird to me. I don't understand that. Probably my favorite part of the Crimecasters coverage, though, was when Alyssa Sophias said this to Darren Larner, who is now the retired original lead investigator from the case. I'm going to post the link to this video on my Facebook page, but you guys have to promise to watch it because it's so interesting. And this happens at the end. So she says to him, talking about Artis, he says that during your investigation, you portrayed him to the community as a cold-blooded killer, a womanizer, an intelligent, plot-planning, narcissistic psychotic. And this man, completely deadpan, just looks at her and goes, right. So she clarifies, you're okay with that description? And he says, Absolutely. About Artis. So he was put on leave by the Michigan State Police during the initial investigation. After a few months passed and no charges had been filed, he was reinstated, but he was transferred from the Lansing Post to the Flint Post. He married the coworker that he was having an affair with at the time of Bernita's murder, and they are still married today. In 2003, 2 years after Bernita's murder, Artis self-published a book called Who Killed My Wife? Okay, OJ. I always swore that I was never going to read this book, and I haven't. I would say that reading it is a loose term, but I have skimmed it. I had to while I was researching this episode. So just within the past couple days, I've thumbed through it, but I did not buy it. I don't know if you even can buy it anymore, but Bernita's family runs a Facebook page called Justice for Bernita, and they scanned the entire book and created a Google Drive file that anybody can download for free. It's pinned right to the top of that page, so you can go right to the Justice for Bernita Facebook page, look at the pinned posts. It's like the first or second one is the file link to Artis's book, so that's a way for you to look through it if you're curious without supporting him or giving him money in any way, because fuck that guy. And the book is exactly what I thought it was going to be. It's not an investigation by a trained law enforcement officer into what happened to his wife. It is a self-serving, self-centered pile of cow dung. I personally think it makes him look even more guilty. This is a man with a flair for the dramatic, after all, who went on to have a long, I don't think career is the right word, in community theater. He's very active in community theater. There, that's it. In 2009, he released some bullshit documentary called Living Accused about the burden of living under the cloud of suspicion. I couldn't find that anywhere to watch it. I don't think I would have been able to stomach it anyways, but apparently it exists. In 2018, he and his wife both retired from the Michigan State Police, and between them, they were set to draw a pension of nearly $1 million. They now live out on a lake in a small community north of Lansing, and I think that this is what makes me so mad about this case, right? Everybody knows that he did it. We've always known that he did it. From the moment it went public that Bernita White had filed for divorce from her cop husband and was afraid of him, that she told multiple people, if anything happens to me, Artis did it. That one of the last things her mother ever said was, Artis did it. Like, we have always known. And yet this man got everything he wanted. He got the kids, he got the house, he got Bernita's life insurance policy, he got to keep his job and his pension, he got to marry his mistress. I don't want to talk too much about Bernita's girls because what they went through was so traumatic, but they believe their dad is innocent. They have been supportive of him, and according to the social medias that I was able to find, they maintain a good relationship with him today. They're both in their 30s, I think, now. So he won, and that makes me so mad. He got everything, and what did Bernita get? Because not justice. Detective Sergeant Darren Lerner describes the case like this. You always start at the center, and you work your way out. And despite their best efforts to pursue other avenues, investigators have never made it out of that circle because the answer has always been right there. Yet in 25 years, Artis White has never been arrested, never charged. LPD investigators presented the case to the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office twice, but the prosecutor declined to pursue charges both times. And then the Michigan State Police presented the case to the Attorney General's Office twice, and they also declined to pursue charges. Prosecutors have just never felt that the evidence, which is mostly circumstantial, was strong enough for a slam dunk conviction, and they've only got one shot at this, so they have to get it right when they do it. Another thing that's crazy is that Artis has always accused law enforcement officials of having it out for him, which is not how that works. Like, if we know anything, we know that if there's any shady business going on in an investigation, law enforcement is going to protect law enforcement, not target Like, they would have done the opposite. If they were going to mishandle the case, it would have been to his benefit not to accuse him, because it makes them look awful that one of their troopers is a fucking sniper, cold-blooded murderer. Right? But just to reiterate how ridiculous Artis's accusation that the police have been wrongfully after him all these years is, let's recap, just for funsies, because I know that I've thrown a lot at you today. Bernita White filed for divorce and full custody of her two daughters on May 24th, 2001. Less than a month later, she was dead. According to pretty much all of Bernita's friends and family members, she was afraid of Artis, she thought he was going to do something to her, and she believed he was following, stalking, and spying on her. It was later proven that Artis did hire a PI to follow Bernita around, and he did use police software to track Bernita and her acquaintances. Less than 2 weeks before she was killed, Bernita submitted a letter to the court, the contents of which remain unknown, regarding the judge's temporary ruling for 50-50 custody. It is believed that that letter contained information as to why Artis should not be allowed custody of his daughters. Bernita was terrified to leave her girls with Artis and refused to agree to joint custody at a hearing just a couple weeks before her death. Due to the circumstances of the shooting, police were able to determine that this was a planned sniper attack and Bernita was the intended target. Artis had the motive, the means, and the time, despite what he says, to kill Bernita. One comment that I read, and I think it might have come from Detective Sergeant Larner, I'm not real sure, I read so much and I didn't write this down, but I'm recalling it now, is Artis was a really, really good shot. When the officers would go like out to the gun range together, he was just spot on, and they would make jokes about how, oh, Bernita better be careful of you, we better watch out for you. So he absolutely had the skill to carry out this hit. Due to the family's hectic plans that kept changing that day, runaway dog, two birthday parties, this kid here, that kid there, now let's go, okay, now you go, just leave us here and you come back. Like, it was a lot of chaos, right? Artis was the only person who knew where Bernita was in that moment. The decision for her to walk to the zoo was a last-minute one, and just moments after Artis left her to do that, she was killed. His actions at the scene, at the hospital, his unwillingness to cooperate beyond that first interview, that fucking bullshit book, and I am sure, nay, positive, that there are things we, the public, don't know, because this is still an open case and there is going to be information that is being kept secret in case investigators are ever able to bring a case against Artis for the murder of his wife. There has got to be here in 2026 some new technology or process that can aid in finding that smoking gun, that one piece of irrefutable evidence that would at least warrant taking this thing to trial. It has been 25 years since Bernita White was murdered at Potter Park Zoo. It's time to put the animal that killed her in a cage. My sources for today's episode were, first and foremost, the incredible work that the Crimecasters Network did on this case. I also listened to episodes of the podcasts Black Girl Gone and Crimes in Closets. Lots of old Lansing State Journal articles, and of course, my own recollection, because I've been following this case since the day that it happened. And that is it for me today, friends. For even more Great Lakes true crime, be sure to check out this week's episode of Already Gone wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up with all things Michigan Monsters, you can find me on Facebook and Instagram under Michigan Monsters Podcast, under TikTok under It's Jen Carpenter, and online under MichiganMonstersPodcast.com. I'm Jen Carpenter, and I will see you next time. Although I'm not sure when that will be, there are some changes that are going to be coming to the show here pretty soon, unfortunately, and I will make an announcement once it's all been figured out. The best way to stay updated on what's happening is to follow me on socials, Facebook particularly. I'm not very active on Instagram, so make sure that you're following the Michigan Monsters Podcast Facebook page for updates. Until then, remember to keep your doors locked, even during the daytime, because not all monsters hide in the dark. Thank you.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.